Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, ranked in the top 20 among national public universities in the latest U.S. News & World Report. FSU specialty license plates support scholarships for deserving students. More on FSU specialty plates is at fsu.edu/mytag. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's bill to crack down on protests that police deem violent had been stalled, but it's now on the move again.
Because I firmly believe, as I believe everybody should, that the rioting that took place completely took away from what was with the redress that was sought through the peaceful protests over the summer.
Also tonight, it's the state of Florida versus the federal government over whether or not cruise ships can sail again. We'll have a report on the legal battle.
And this is something that we don't believe can continue any longer.
We'll also talk with an expert about the serious consequences transgender girls and women might face as a result of the state's proposed ban on them taking part in scholastic sports. I'm Tom Flanagan. We close out the sixth week in the nine-week-long Florida lawmaking session. This is Capitol Report. The Florida Senate was taking up a plan today to raise criminal penalties for violence that occurs during protests. It would also create some new crimes in connection with such activities. The bill, a priority for Governor Ron DeSantis, who announced it in the middle of social justice protests during the summer. But as Lynn Hatter reports, the measure has faced challenges in the legislative process.
The Florida House has already approved its version of the bill, but the Senate version stalled for more than a month after Democrat and Criminal Justice Committee Chairman Jason Pizzo refused to hear it. Senate President Wilton Simpson used a procedural move to break the logjam, sending the House version of the bill to the Chamber's Appropriations Committee, where Democrats presented more than a dozen amendments in an effort to defang the bill. All of them failed.
And as I sat in my legislative office over the summer, I heard protesters at certain times of the day walking up and down Central Avenue. And at one point, I joined them as they blocked the intersection of Fifth Street and Central Avenue to peacefully protest. And I encouraged them to be peaceful and to protest.
St. Petersburg Democratic Senator Daryl Roussan worries the measure cracks down on dissent, a tenet of American democracy, and it does so in a way that would hurt Black and minority voices. Some protests erupted into violence, including ones in Roussan's district, which is also represented by Republican Senator Danny Burgess, the protest's bill sponsor. Burgess cited riots last May in the area where a Champs store was burned as part of his defense of the bill. The measure removes lawsuit immunity from communities and counties that don't allow their law enforcement agencies to intervene. Roussan says he was present after the Champs store burned.
I walked that parking lot. I saw the shameful display of violence that occurred to that store. And I was there when the University of South Florida football players and students showed up to clean up what violent rioters messed up. But that would open, this bill would open up the city of Tampa to litigation to determine whether or not they adequately sent police personnel or whether they made a decision for the safety of their officers to not send them in, but wait.
An amendment calling for a study on race and protests was also defeated to the consternation of Russell Meyer with the Florida Council of Churches. He noted disparate treatment in Black and white protesters, a trend also noted in an analysis of protests by Business Insider.
I've been in the streets since the killing of Trayvon Martin with many different groups. My observation is when white evangelical pastors like me are in the streets with our Black and brown siblings, law enforcement stays to the side and respects the peaceful protest. But when it's just been Black and brown siblings in the streets, law enforcement uses excessive use of force in order to silence their voices.
How law enforcement treats protesters and concerns about racial biases are front and center in arguments against the bill. The issue, says Pizzo, is one that has to be considered given how racially charged the issue of protesting is.
I'm a white Christian male. I have had little, if anything, to protest in my life. I never had to go to a different water fountain, never had to sit on a different part of the bus, never had to worry about what school I applied to. I've had little, if nothing, to protest about. Black folks in America have had a reason to protest, and therefore they're always, always, overwhelmingly going to be disparately resulting in numbers of high arrests and convictions, prosecutions, because Senator Burgess and I have had nothing to protest in our lifetime.
In addition to increasing the penalties for crimes that happen during riots, the bill also creates new crimes like mob intimidation, cyber intimidation, commonly called doxing, and the destruction of monuments and historical properties. The bill is also aimed at discouraging city and county commissions from cutting police budgets. It's a direct response, Burgess notes, to calls to, quote, defund the police. Burgess maintains his bill is about protecting peaceful protests, not discouraging them.
At the end of the day, I don't believe, I'll reiterate this again, I do not believe that this will deter or discourage peaceful protests. I hope that it only encourages and fosters peaceful protests. That is certainly my intent with this legislation, because I firmly believe, as I believe everybody should, that the rioting that took place completely took away from what the redress that was sought through the peaceful protests over the summer.
Republicans are holding firm despite some having private misgivings. The Senate has scheduled a Saturday morning meeting to resume talks. I'm Len Hatter.
Florida is suing the federal government over its continued pause on cruise ships sailing in U.S. waters. The no-sale order took effect last March, early in the COVID-19 pandemic. Governor Ron DeSantis held a news conference in Miami on Thursday to explain the state's reasoning for the lawsuit. As Valerie Crowder reports, the focus was mostly on jobs.
Several thousand cruise line workers in Florida filed for unemployment within the first 6 months of the pandemic, and nearly 50,000 cruise employees lost their jobs. That's according to a report from the Federal Maritime Commission released last fall. DeSantis told reporters that's why his administration is fighting the federal government over its no-sail order.
If you look at Miami-Dade County, even though the state of Florida is far below the national average in terms of the unemployment rate, here in Dade County, it's one of the highest unemployment rates in the entire state, and it's way higher than the state average and higher than even the national average. And the main reason for that is because the federal government and the CDC has locked down this industry for over a year.
Cruise lines are still planning trips in the Caribbean. DeSantis says people are going to take those trips anyway. They just won't leave Florida's ports.
They're going to fly to the Bahamas. And they're going to get on the ships from the Bahamas, and they're going to spend the money in the Bahamas, and then they're going to do the same thing that they would have done. It just won't be helping the state of Florida, and it won't be helping our folks here who really depend on it. So how does that make any sense? It doesn't. It's irrational, and this is something that we don't believe can continue any longer.
U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidance states coronavirus outbreaks are more likely on cruise ships compared to other settings. That's because passengers and crew members live and work in especially close quarters, making it difficult to practice social distancing. Carnival Cruise Lines recently announced a policy to require people to show proof that they've been inoculated before they may board. But DeSantis recently signed an executive order barring businesses from requiring people to show proof they've received the COVID-19 vaccine before receiving service.
The legislature, though, is going to basically codify that. I've been looking at some of the drafts they're working on, so I feel confident we'll do it. Texas will do it. Georgia will do it. South Carolina. Some other states will start doing it. So there'll be enough states that do it that you're not going to have any major company have to insist on it because it'll just hurt their business too much.
Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody, who's a Republican, joined DeSantis at the press conference where she touted the governor's willingness to take on the CDC on this issue.
We are not going to sit back while an administrative agency decides to shut down an entire industry. 60% of the nation's cruises come out of Florida. Almost $8 billion is injected into Florida's economy because of this thriving industry.
Moody says the lawsuit seeks to get the CDC's no-sale order lifted before it expires in November. I'm Valerie Crowder.
30% of people with diabetes who depend on insulin say they've had to choose between paying their utility bill and buying the medicine they need to stay alive. A survey by the American Diabetes Association found about 23% of insulin users say they miss doses weekly because they can't afford it. Health experts say that can have life-threatening consequences. A bill before the legislature this session would cap the cost Floridians with insurance could be charged each month for insulin. But Regan McCarthy reports that measure is stalled in the House.
One in four people with type 1 diabetics have reported insulin underuse due to the high cost of insulin.
That's Boynton Beach Democratic Senator Lori Berman. She's speaking in support of a measure that would cap the price people in Florida who have health insurance could be required to pay for insulin. Under the measure, a person with health insurance could not be required to pay more than $100 for a month's supply of insulin. Berman says the change is needed because the current cost of the drug is forcing people to risk their health.
I had the privilege of providing care for a lovely young woman who was diagnosed with diabetes type 1 at the age of 3. Since her diagnosis in 1991, she and her parents meticulously managed her disease.
Anastasia Albanese O'Neill is the director of operations for the Diabetes Education Clinic at the University of Florida. She says that careful management kept her patient out of the hospital from the time she was diagnosed until 2009, when she was a senior in college. She was hospitalized for a life-threatening complication caused by a lack of insulin. A week later, Albanese O'Neill says she was able to meet with her patient again.
She looked very sad. She didn't meet my eyes like she usually did. She said the hospital stay had been frightening. She hadn't been back in the hospital before she could remember as a 3-year-old. She said she was very sick by the time she sought care in the emergency room. And for the first time, she explained that both of her parents had lost their jobs in the recession of 2008. At 21, she wasn't eligible for Medicaid. So after COBRA had run out and she had exhausted her UF student health insurance, she started rationing insulin, and this led to her hospitalization.
Albanese O'Neill says more than a decade later, the same factors that led to her patient risking her life because she couldn't afford her medication still haven't been addressed today. And she says they lead to people making choices that are more costly in the long run. She says chronic complications are linked to the long-term rationing of insulin.
Amputations in the state of Florida are almost $100,000 per amputation. So that is a significant cost to the system. It is blindness. Diabetes is the leading cause of blindness in adults. That is a significant cost. Dialysis for kidney failure. Over $40 billion a year is spent on dialysis. Not all of it is caused by diabetes, but certainly that is a significant downstream cost that we can prevent by making insulin affordable and not having one in four people with diabetes ration their insulin at the front end.
But Audrey Brown, president of the Florida Association of Health Plans, says the plan to cap the costs insured people would pay doesn't address the real reason for rising insulin costs. She says insurance companies don't set the price. Manufacturers do.
We don't often get a look into how drug manufacturers set their list price for their products. But last year in the Senate Banking and Insurance Committee, a drug manufacturer described in testimony when they set their list price, and I'm going to directly quote, "We look at the value that the product brings or the medicine brings to the patient. What are the improvements over the course of their life? And sometimes those medications are life-saving. So we factor that into the price that we set."
Brown says one thing state governments could do that could help address spiking insulin costs might be improving price transparency at a state level. Fleming Island Republican Representative Sam Garrison says his daughter has type 1 diabetes and depends on insulin. He calls the current situation a market breakdown. But the move to cap costs appears dead for this session. The House bill is awaiting its first committee hearing, but that committee has already had its final scheduled meeting of the current legislative session. During that meeting, the panel held a workshop on the issue, but didn't hear or vote on the bill. I'm Regan McCarthy.
A bill heading to the Florida House floor would effectively ban transgender women and girls from competing in women and girls' school sports teams. The measure's sponsor says this ban is needed because biological males have a physical advantage over biological females when it comes to sports. Robbie Gaffney speaks with Janet Silverstein, a pediatric endocrinologist who works at the UF Health's Youth Gender Program that provides services to transgender and gender nonconforming youth and their families. The conversation begins with a discussion of the changes transgender girls go through when undergoing hormone therapy.
Okay, the trans females is really what we're talking about here. And the trans females are born male, so they can make testosterone. However, we block the testosterone with hormone blockers. And when we block the testosterone in the informed consent, one of the biggest things that we talk about is the fact that they will early on lose muscle mass and they will lose strength. And that is probably the first thing that we see as far as changes go. So they lose that early. And when they're ready, we will start estrogen. But again, that doesn't happen right away. It'll take a while before we start estrogen. The whole process is a long process because it's a slow, very gradual process. But even after the first hormone blocker shot, they lose muscle mass and they lose strength. And really, when it all is said and done and they've started estrogen, after a year or so, their muscle strength, their muscle mass is no different than that of the natal female.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because, you know, Tuck was saying that, oh, there's differences between biological men and biological women. And because of this, biological males have an advantage over biological females. So we need to keep them separate. But it sounds like you're saying if you're a transgender woman and you're going through hormone therapy, you're no different from a cisgender woman. Do I have that correct?
Yeah, that's pretty true. Yes.
And so part of this bill, if there's a dispute over a student's sex, so someone says, you're not a girl, you're really a boy or a biological male, the student would then have to go to a physician to verify their sex. And it would have to be based on their reproductive anatomy, genetic makeup, and normal produced testosterone levels. In your opinion, is that a good way to determine someone's sex?
No, we actually legally change their gender and we legally change their name when they're ready for those things. And in reality, I don't think the word sex is a good way to describe them. I think that who they are is really who they are physiologically. And once they've undergone their, you know, the treatment to become a female, they basically are females.
So do you think, in your opinion, that looking at someone's reproductive anatomy as a way to say whether you're a girl or a guy is a good way to go about verifying a student's sex?
To label somebody or male as male or female based solely on that, I don't think is fair for these transgender youth.
And what about their genetic makeup or normal produced testosterone levels?
We have blocked them. Once the estrogen level is high enough, it causes suppression of the hormone from the brain called LH, which is what stimulates the testes to produce testosterone. And so once you block that, it doesn't make testosterone anymore. So we always get testosterone levels and they're low.
Yeah, so a companion bill in the Senate by Senator Kelly Stargell, it allows transgender women and girls to compete, but their testosterone has to be below 10 nanomoles per meter. I might be pronouncing the first nano word incorrectly, but can you explain what that is?
That's a very low testosterone level. And there are girls who are natal females who have a condition called polycystic ovary syndrome, and they are XX. They have uteruses or uteri, and they have higher testosterone levels than many of these transgender females, many of them.
You know, what do you think of saying, all right, you know, transgender woman, you can compete, but you can only compete if your levels are at 10 nanomoles. I might be pronouncing that word incorrectly. What do you think of that, you know, keeping to that number? Is that...
I think a number is not a particularly good way to do it. I mean, yes, I think you need to measure testosterone levels. And if they're high enough, if they're in the male range, sure, then that would be an uneven playing field. But if it's not in the male range, anything below the male range, I think should be acceptable.
So what do you think the effect would be on a transgender woman or transgender girl's kind of psyche if they were told, hey, you can't compete in women's and girls' school sports? What do you, you know, you deal with this population in your transgender clinic. What do you think that psychological effect would be on them?
Devastating. It would be devastating for them because, you know, they want to be accepted. They want to be accepted for who they are. And there's no reason to really ban them physiologically.
And what do you think the effect would be if lawmakers were like, okay, you can compete, but you have to keep your testosterone levels at that 10 number?
I think that they want to have low testosterone levels because they feel that they're girls. And they are girls. If you look at them, they look like girls. There are many actresses, for instance, who are transgender. Some models are transgender. And you'd never know. I think that as long as you're able to compete, they would feel fine.
Thank you so much for speaking with me. I do appreciate it.
You're welcome. You take care.
That was Capitol reporter Robbie Gaffney speaking with Janet Silverstein, a pediatric endocrinologist who works at UF Health's Youth Gender Program. You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, more and more examples of what were called everyday life in the time before the pandemic are coming back online. Professional wrestling's biggest live event, WrestleMania, is happening in Tampa this weekend. It's been 12 months since the coronavirus pandemic prompted it to be moved to Orlando and taped without fans in attendance. The WWE is dividing what used to be a one-day extravaganza into shows on Saturday and Sunday. Just 25,000 fans each night will be admitted at Raymond James Stadium. That was the same spot where it had been set to take place last year. WUSF's Mark Schreiner spoke to Dave Meltzer, editor of the Wrestling Observer newsletter, about what fans can expect.
It's good for Tampa in the sense that they had done all that planning and then lost out on the event. And while it's not the same scope as it would have been a year ago, but at least Tampa is getting the event. And, you know, it's a unique event. It's the first ticketed event and the first event of its kind at this level that wrestling has done in this country in a long, long time, in more than a year.
What do we know about crowd capacity for the two nights, as well as the COVID-19 precautions that WWE, Raymond James, the organizers are taking?
I mean, the number that they said is 25,000 people, and most of the tickets are sold. There are tickets left. I don't know how many exactly they put on sale. Whatever they're set up for, they're going to be pretty much packed.
A lot of times, WrestleMania draws travelers not just from the United States, but internationally. I got to assume that's going to be affected.
Yeah, way, way, way down. I mean, even like in a year where, let's say, like there's 60,000 people at WrestleMania, I would bet you that the people who travel is probably 70, 75,000, because I know when I would go that there were people who traveled in for that week that didn't even go to WrestleMania. You know, it's like people who come to town for the Super Bowl. They don't all come to the Super Bowl game itself.
The smaller independent wrestling companies that normally hold events the week of WrestleMania so they can tap into those crowds, how is that going to be affected this year, do you think?
It exists. There are shows, but the shows are not at the magnitude as they are in a normal year. It's not even close. I mean, it used to be I would know guys who would do 8 or 9 or 10 matches in a week, you know, going from promotion to promotion to promotion. There are guys who are coming in, but most of those guys aren't even coming in because it's just not enough shows. And the international stars aren't coming in because of the quarantine of going back.
Let's leave pro wrestling for a moment. The biggest mixed martial arts company, Ultimate Fighting Championship, the UFC, they're holding an event April 24th at a 15,000-seat indoor arena in Jacksonville, Florida. They've sold out the entire place. No social distancing. What are your thoughts on that?
When your standard is below pro wrestling, it's kind of telling. WWE, they're outdoors, which is much safer than indoors, and they're selling less than half of the building. These guys are going 100% capacity indoors. I think it's terribly irresponsible, but they got the tickets, and they're going to gloat about being the first ones.
Both WWE and UFC, you're seeing them come to Florida as opposed to other states. Why is that?
Because Governor DeSantis said that anyone who does national television in Florida can do whatever they want. You know, you can run in a lot of states, but, you know, the strictness may be different. But Florida's been, and Texas have said, you can do whatever you want.
And lastly, why should people who aren't wrestling fans care about WrestleMania and the effect it's going to have on the Tampa Bay area as well as some of the businesses?
Well, you don't have to care about wrestling. I mean, it's solid economic impact. It's not what it was going to be, which is nobody's fault. It's just what happened. It would have been a gigantic event last year and even this year if things had worked out differently. It's still a big event. The quality of the live event will probably be very similar to what it would have been before. And actually, I think the crowd in some ways will be better because they're going to be so starved for live wrestling that I think they're going to react tremendously up and down the show. So I think it'll be a very entertaining two shows. There are still going to be a lot of tourists coming into the area for this event. It's not at the level that it would have been, you know, in a normal year, but nothing has been this year.
That was Wrestling Observer Newsletter editor Dave Meltzer speaking with WUSF's Mark Schreiner. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Valerie Crowder, Robbie Gaffney, Blaise Gainey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to Mark Schreiner. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Please join us every evening at this time throughout the 2021 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. And from Florida State University, ranked in the top 20 among national public universities in the latest U.S. News & World Report. FSU specialty license plates support scholarships for deserving students. More on FSU specialty plates is at fsu.edu/mytag.